you.
I am.
You're welcome.
Hi. Good. I think we have Lucy on the social media.
Hi, Ellen. Good morning.
You want to sit here?
We have some more people who are coming.
Yeah, I know.
You know what? Should I move some chairs out of the rest
of the No. I think maybe we could leave. No. People who come in will. Okay. But we don't want Gabby to have to move out. We have some chairs on the
chair.
We have many more right out here.
Good morning. Welcome back. How many years are we doing this?
That's what I was wondering.
I just want to think.
Five.
At least five years.
We're going to need some more chairs. Because we have, we have about five more people who are coming than I know of.
Okay. Hello.
Karina's on her way. We don't want Gabby to have to move out, which she does.
Hello.
Hey, Charlotte.
Hey. When did you get here?
2 weeks ago?
Yeah.
Hi, Lindsay.
I'd like to welcome everyone to our first class of this year. As I understand, this is our fifth year, and it's really exciting that this has grown. It's just such a wonderful and anticipated class, and everybody looks forward to it when you come. I mean, Hank, and it's wonderful having you. And I have to tell everyone, I was in Israel when Mishmat had the 10th graduation class of the Yoatzot Halakha, which was the most magnificent evening. Very enlightening. I don't want to take that time, but beautifully done. And very impressive that the next morning when I opened up the Jerusalem Post, the front page had an article about Mishmat, a wonderful article that was very laudatory. And of course, I Rabbi Nick was in the front page of her picture right there. So I was very proud. I'd like to greet everyone today, and we look forward to studying Eov, which is difficult, so I know we're going to do very well. And on behalf of all of us here, I would like to, Gabby, give you our condolences, tell you how much we loved Ima, Hilda Rebeck, Aleha Shalom, her chair here. I just see her here. She's always been a model to me and to, I'm sure, many of us here because of her learning, her love of Torah, and how smart she was. We all wish we could be on that level, her memory, and everything that she, every time she said something, it was intelligent and to the point. And we shall miss her very much, but we shall continue to learn in her honor, in her memory, and she will be here with us. And I have to say, you are a most wonderful daughter. I know you don't like praise, so I'm not going to say anything.
You know that she loved being here and seeing all of you and studying.
Yes, thank you very much. So we will, Rabbanit would like to tell us that this class is going to be in memory of, I still remember this was his name.
Seymour.
Shimon Ben Moshe. His website's today, but he said a few words. Thank you.
And before I start, we have a very special invitation to issue to everyone, and I'm going to ask Sharon, who will be hosting us, to issue the invitation.
Okay, thank you very much. This is a very exciting annual event. We're having another special preview at Sotheby's, November 22nd, Sunday, November 22nd. It's not open to the public then. It's just a private time where American Friends of Nishmat and people who would like to join are welcome to come and to see some really interesting things. And I actually hadn't told Khan the highlight of this sale. Came in, got an export license, thank God, last week as we were going to press. It is the earliest decorated Esther scroll, and it was written in Venice in 1564 by Estelina Bat Hakatzin Menachem. It was written by a woman, which is in and of itself a very, very interesting phenomenon. It's the only pre-modern scroll that we know of that was written by a woman, and to be the first earliest decorated one is, like, unbelievable. So there's going to be all kinds of interesting things going on there, and if people did not get invitations in the mail, you should have gotten them yesterday or today. You're welcome to take one. I'll leave them over here for you, and we look forward to having you join us. It should be another nice event.
Sharon, did she write and decorate? Did she?
She katafti zot amigzeh megillah v'siyamti otah b'yom so and so. She said she wrote it and she finished it. We don't know if that includes the art. Very cool. Very cool.
Wow.
So, yeah. Interesting.
And thank you, Sharon, for the way she disperses
her because
it really is something very special.
It's a fun morning. Everybody enjoys it.
So, I want to introduce our learning. It's extraordinary that we're here, Gabby, in your home for a fifth year. Really extraordinary. And this chair is, of course, this chair is, of course, very, very empty. And I really don't think, I certainly don't have words, and I really don't think probably that anyone who's here in the room has words to talk about. just how missing and how missed Reptin Hilda Rebeck is. I have to say that I really feel her here with us, very much here with us. I think her neshama is delighted that we're sitting here and we're continuing to learn in Gabby's beautiful home that has become a Beit Vad L'Chachamot. It's so extraordinary to have a regular shiur going on in your home, and I feel, even though we're not going to have Reverend Hilda with us, to give us just the perfect pasuk for, you know, to give religious resonance to every to everything we're encountering, even though we're not going to have that. She was a, you know, someone who was a woman of short physical stature, but really a towering spiritual presence. So even though she's not going to give us those psukim, I think what she would tell us excuse me, is now it's up to you to find those psukim. Now it's up to you to move forward with that spirit. So in that spirit, we're going to begin our fifth season of classes here in the study of Sefer Iyov. And thank you. Today is the yard site of Mr. Seymour Pratt. And so what could be possibly more fitting? Gabby, thank you. You've opened your home to us for all of
us.
It's extraordinary that we're beginning the year on his yard site. And of course, this class is dedicated Le'inui Neshama of Shimon Ben Moshe and Mr. Seymour Pratt. Shimon Ben Moshe Behinda. It used to be that people would only say the man's name, and it's very important that we have the opportunity to remember Shimon Ben Moshe Behinda. May this be an Eloi Neshama. Before we start, I want to ask you something. Who here has learned Sefer Iyov?
At some point.
Okay.
A long time ago.
100 years ago. Okay. I think that I've heard as people are coming up in the elevator a little bit of trepidation. Now, what are we taking upon ourselves? I don't know how long we will be studying Eov together. It may take considerably longer than 1 year, but I expect this learning to be both meaningful. Hopefully, there will be moments of enjoyment, certainly intellectual enjoyment, and I hope that this book will lift our spirits. So this is a sefer. This is a sefer that is very central to me, to my life. And let's see what we can do with it together. First, let me give you a picture of the structure of the book. I want to remind everyone, as we continue through the year, please bring your Tanakhs with you. You'll get little love letters about the assignment in advance. Okay. The structure of the book is as follows. It begins with what we call in Hebrew Sipur HaMisgere, the framework, the story which represents the framework. The story is going to appear at the beginning of the book, and it's going to appear at the end again at the closing of the book. So there's the story. Between the two parts of the story, the opening of the story and the surprise end to the surprise end has to do at least with the way I understand the ending of the book. So even if you read the ending of the book, I think there's going to be a surprise ending for us. So please keep that in mind to encourage us. Between the beginning of the book and the end of the book, there is a speech by Eov, and there are three cycles of his friends speaking up. He is visited by three friends who come in order to comfort him. Each one in turn speaks up, and Eov responds. The next one speaks up, and there is a maneh, a response from Eov. And then the third one speaks up, there's a response from Eov. That ends the first cycle, and then the second cycle begins, and then the third cycle begins. Then, after we complete three cycles of a friend speaking up and Eov responds, a friend speaks up, Eov responds, and at the end of the three cycles, they don't speak up for a fourth cycle because he just hasn't bought what they've said. They've each spoken, their words have become progressively stronger, and despite the fact, I'm a great fan of Eov, I'm really a great fan of Eov, despite the fact that their words have become extremely strong and they're very self-righteous by the end in their attacks upon Eov. Initially they're comforting, but by the end their words become very, very strong as he has rejected their words. They don't speak after the three cycles because Eov has rejected their words and they can't find anything new to say. Then there's a new character who appears, and his name is Elihu ben Barachel. He appears, he speaks his words, and then God answers Eov. And then the story closes. So that's the structure of the book. How many of you have had the chance to read the two prakim that were assigned? No? Some? Didn't get the assignment?
No assignment
reached you. What?
No email,
no assignment reached you. Okay, next time there's Rav Hashem, the assignment will reach you. Let's retool and let's have someone read the first two prakim. I think what we'll do is read the prakim in English. Yes?
Could you just give a word about, was there an argument to put this in the canon?
No.
Was there any history?
There's no argument about, the arguments about canonizing do not include the book of Eov, but I will be speaking about, was there a historical figure of Eov? But I want us to get the storyline first. So, where's Shlomit? Shlomit, can you run through the first parak in Hebrew? Someone else will run through it in English. Okay? Excuse me, friends. You know, of course, that the forgive the sublime to the ridiculous, but the Wizard of Oz is a translation of where Eov is from. Her man was from Eretz Utz, Utz Az. Okay. Ishaya Beretz Utz. Shlomit is going to read this through in Hebrew, and then we're going to read it in English. Go ahead.
וחמש מאות אתונות ועבודה רבה מאוד והיא הישוב גדול מכל בני קדם והלכו בניו ועשו משתבת איש ימו ושלחו וקראו לשלושת אחיותיהם לאכול ולשתות עמהם והיהי כי הקיף ימי המשתה וישלח איוב היקדשם וישכים בבוקר ואלה עולו מספר כולם כי אמר איוב אולי חטאו בניי וברכו
Okay, let's. Who's going to read the English? Who's reading the English first? Great, go ahead, Ruth.
There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. That man was wholesome and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. Seven sons and three daughters were born to him. His possessions consisted of 7,000 sheep and goats, 3,000 camels, 500 pairs of cattle, 500 she-donkeys, and very many enterprises. That man was the wealthiest man of all the people in the East.
B'nei Kedem is here being translated by your translation as in the East. It's a legitimate translation, but we're going to look at some parallel references and see that Kedem is the name of a place. So he was the wealthiest man of all of the citizens of Kedem, all of the citizens, perhaps of the East or perhaps of Kedem. Go on. Oh, go on reading.
Valchubana. His sons would go and make a feast at each one's home, each on his set day, and they would send word and invite their three sisters to eat and drink with them. When each cycle of feast days had ended, Job would send to summon them. He would rise early in the morning and bring as many burnt offerings as the number of them all. For Job said to himself, "Perhaps my children have sinned and blasphemed Hashem in their hearts." Thus would Job do all the days.
We're going to do the analyzing later, but I just want to point out some things to you. Let me point something out about this man's affluence, about the wealth. What did he own? He owned 7,000... Well, first of all, everything is going to add up to 10 here. You see the cycles of 10. Which is very often a symbolic number in any event. He owned 7,000 sheep. The purpose of sheep in the biblical world is what?
Wool.
Is wool. You have Simchat Hagez appearing when Yehuda was shearing his sheep. When you have it with, remember, Amnon went to shear his sheep and there was a great feasting. So sheep is one form of economic undertaking, and he had 7,000 heads of sheep. And then he had 3,000 camels. What's the purpose of a camel?
Transportation.
So he has a fleet of 3,000 trucks. He has a fleet of 3,000 trucks. He has 7,000 sheep. What else does he have?
500 oxen.
What's the purpose? What does an ox do?
Plowing.
Now, an ox, I was thinking about this morning. 500 oxen, how many acres does he have? You're going to do your plowing at one point in the year. You're not going to spread your plowing over 30 days or 60 days. My guess is that an ox can probably do 5 acres. It's just a guess. A pair of oxen, the ox is pulling a plow. So if you have an 8-hour workday, a 10-hour workday, I presume one pair of oxen is going to cover about 5 acres. So how many acres of holdings would you say this man has? How much? 2,500 acres. Maybe it's much considerably more. Maybe my estimate might be modest, but it's definitely not overestimated. Va'avudah ba'ma'od, numerous servants. We don't even have the numbers of his servants. The servants are, of course, his workmen. And he has all of these workmen out there in the field with his sheep and with his cattle and with his with all that he's planting. And we're told that this man was wealthier than everyone in B'nai Kedem. Okay, again, the storyline, he has these 10 children, 7 sons. What do? Each day they feast. They feast together every day.
Each day, or set days, each yomo, each one on his day.
So it seems, and it says, "Kacha yaseh Yov kol hayamim." Such would do Yov. So it seems that they have a cycle, and the cycle is that every day they're getting together and they're feasting together in the middle of the day. This each time at the home of another member of the family, and then when the cycle finishes, what does Eov do? Then he brings karbanot. Why does he bring karbanot? He gets them up early in the morning that next day. That next day they're up early in the morning, and early in the morning Eov sanctifies them. Vaykadshem probably means he readies them. Eov sends and he readies them. They've all been, the younger generation has all been together, and they've all been lunching together daily. And then Eov sends, awakens early in the morning, offers olot in the number of all of them, because what does he say?
They're thinking bad thoughts.
Birkat Hashem is a term that occurs twice in the Tanakh. In the Torah, the word is stated directly. It is Elokim lo tekalel, you shall not curse God. And you have at the end of Parshat Emor the Mekalel who is executed. Birkat Hashem used euphemistically, blessing of God, lest they bless God, occurs here. Do you know where else in Tanakh it occurs? Where? I don't hear. No. In the Torah, it is not used euphemistically. The Torah states specifically, you shall not curse God. Elokim lo tekalel. And the very difficult story of the Mekalel, who was taken out and put to death, it occurs at the end of Parshat Emor, and there's no euphemism there. But where do you have a euphemism? Look in Melachim Aleph Kaf Aleph. Let's see, am I in the right place?
No.
Long after him. Let's see, it should be. Let's see if I'm right.
Melachim Aleph, what?
Melachim Aleph, I think it should be. Yeah, here it is. Perek Kaf Aleph. Kaf Aleph. That's a chapter that's about whom? Naval and Izebel. It's about Izebel and Ahab. And Izebel set up to have Naval Navot the Israeli executed by having witnesses that what did he do? And take a look at Perek Kaf Aleph, Pasuk Yud. Izebel wants false witnesses to come and testify that what? Berachta Elokim v'melech. This is the other euphemistic use. You have blessed God and the king. Now what is blessing cursing God mean? The word is so horrifying, the notion that man could curse God, that although within the 5 books of the Torah it's not used euphemistically, you have literally stated that one Elokim lo tekalel, or vayekalel, vayikov shem Hashem, in both Iyov and in Melachim, the word isn't said. But rather the opposite is said. It's called Lashon Sagi Nahar, when you use a word euphemistically. And Iyov fears lest they bless God. By saying he fears lest they bless God, his fear is what? That they're going to curse God. Why in the world would they curse God? And what's Eov's fear, in your opinion? And you'll see that this theme is going to repeat itself of blessing God, Birkat Hashem. Birkat Hashem is one of the seven mitzvot b'nei Noach. It is a prohibition. Even a son of Noach is prohibited from cursing God. Any individual who has a Tzelem Elokim is expected to understand a hierarchical relationship between him and God. What's wrong with cursing God? Why is Iyov so terrified? In other words, you have this picture. I would say this picture is a great picture. And when I look at my own children, what I would like to see after I'm gone is a cohesiveness of the family. And to me, it looks wonderful. It makes me so happy when I hear my children are older, they're most of them, but not all are married. When I hear that one has invited the other to come over, nothing makes me happier. I don't have to be there. They're all together, that's wonderful. If they invite me, that's even better.
He's worried about a party atmosphere. Drinking, who knows what will happen.
He doesn't trust them.
I thought he was also worried that if it weren't for him holding it together and all the riches and the good life that he gave them, perhaps without him they would take a different turn and perhaps wouldn't be so righteous on their own and be so oriented to always include the sisters and always be there as that kind of family.
Okay.
Or perhaps he knew characteristics of his own children that were sort of subdued, and he was always praying to God that if they did do something, that he in advance was going to already ask God not only for forgiveness but to make sure that whatever the atonements were, that was all in place for them.
He's not you're projecting onwards, which is very interesting. But he's offering offerings, and a number of them all. Ki amar Iyov ulai chatu banai uberchu Elohim belevavam, because Iyov says maybe my sons have sinned. He's worried that they may have sinned and they may have blessed God in their hearts. I want to know, how do you see what Birkat Hashem means? What's blessing of God? What is it? What's wrong with it?
Well,
yeah.
I don't know if this rises quite to the level of quote blessing God, but I feel like there's a kochi ba'otzem yatzi problem here.
Vayishman yishurun vayivat.
That all this riches, that they'll riches will go to their head and they will not acknowledge that it comes from God.
So Iyov is questioning the capacity of religion to survive in together with comfort. He's not sure that religion and comfort can go together.
Such tremendous affluence, such excess.
His concern is, maybe in their hearts they've blessed God. He's not questioning their deeds, but he's questioning the heart, and he's questioning, can they be truly religious in the face of such blessing? If you don't have anything to pray for, so is there going to be a focus to religion? I remember Razi said, it was probably last year sometime, you were talking about Daniel and prayer and why Daniel was risking his life for prayer. You said, a Jew has to pray, that without prayer you can't be a Jew. And there's nothing that they have missing in their lives. Nikki?
I'm wondering about gratitude. In other words, just sometimes when you have an excess, you realize that you have even more gratitude rather than the opposite. So I'm wondering here whether he's concerned that his kids just don't have the right have the right attitude in terms of gratitude for what they have.
But it's fascinating, because you would say he can be gathering them together, and he'd bring them together and offer a karban todah. He can be offering an offering of gratitude every week. You go through the whole cycle, 7 days, and...
I have problems with that. Wondering why.
And you have this posture of fear at the beginning of the book. He's fearful. Judy?
No, I was thinking, well, I don't know if this is what you're looking for, but I was thinking maybe it says something about Eov, that he is so careful about everything that even in a situation where you wouldn't think anyone would have any reason to rebel against Hashem, he just is so careful that he even brought karbanos just in case, almost as a protective sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. That certainly is one way you could look at this. You could look at this as... just look at this man. He's not even just concerned with deeds. He's even concerned with. He's even concerned less than their hearts. They felt something. Audrey, you said.
No.
Here, I saw here. What was it? Someone on this side wanted to say something.
Well, I there's a very medieval thought that's always in my mind, and that's eye power.
Yeah.
Uh
huh. And he's so blessed. What's he worried about? Worried about the nine heart. But specifically,
that I was
working
on.
Yeah, he's got so much.
And
he
can't
run around
him.
And you see that in life.
So, how, if you say that's his operating principle, how's he combating it?
How does he rise?
How is he combating it?
He can't combat it. Right.
Okay. Let's go on with the story. Shlomit, go on.
ויהי היום ויבואו בני האלוקים להתייצב על השם ויבוא גם השטן בתוכם. ויאמר השם אל השטן, מאין תבוא? ויען השטן את השם, ויאמר משוט בארץ כאילו יתהלך. ויאמר השם אל השטן, ושמת לבך על עבדי איוב, כי אין כמוהו בארץ, איש תם וישר, ירא אלוקים ושר מרם. ויען השטן את השם, ויאמר, החינם ירא איוב אלוקים, הלא רצחת בעדו ובעד ביתו, ובעד כל אשר לו מסביב, מעשה ידיו ברכת, ומקנהו פרץ בארץ. אולם שלחת לידך, וגם בכל אשר לו, אם לא על פניך יברכך. ויאמר השם אל השטן, הנה כל אשר לא בידיך, רק אליו אל תשלח ידיך. ויצא השטן מעיר פני השם.
Ruth, could you read that?
It happened one day. The angels came to stand before God, and Satan too came among them. God said to Satan, from where have you come? The Satan answered God and said, wandering and walking about the earth. God said to the Satan, did you set your heart to take note of my servant Job? For there is no one like him on earth, a wholesome and upright man who fears God and shuns evil. Satan answered God and said, is it for nothing that Job fears God? Have you not set a protective wall about him, about his household, that everything he owns from all around? You have blessed his handiwork and its livestock, have spread throughout the land. Send forth your hand and touch everything that is his, and see if he does not blaspheme you to your face. So God said to the Satan, behold, everything that is his is hereby in your hand. Do not send forth your hand against his person.
Okay. Go on. Go on, please, Shlomit. Vayhi hayom. Pasuk yud gimel.
Vayhi hayom ubanav ubniotav ochlim ushotim yayin bevet achihem abchor. Umalach ba el iyom vayomar habakar hayuchorshot vatonot root al yedihem. ותיפול שבה ותיקחם בעת הנערים יקחו לפי חרב, ואם עלתה רק אני לבדי להגיד לך. עוד זה מדבר וזה בא ויאמר, אש אלוקים נפלה מן השמיים, ותבער בצאן, ובנערים ואוכלם, ואלמלתה רק אני לבדי להגיד לה. עוד זה מדבר, וזה בא ויאמר, כסדים שמו שלושה ראשים ויפשטו על הגמלים, ויתחום, ואת הנערים יקחו לפי חרב, ואלמלתה רק אני לבדי להגיד לה. עד זה מדבר, וזה בא ויאמר, בניך ובנותיך אוכלים ושותים יין בבית אחיהם, עד כה, והנה רוח גדולה באה מעבר הנדבר, ויגע בארבע פינות הבית, ויפול על הנערים וימותו, וימלטה רק אני לבדי להגיד לה. ויקום איוב, ויקרא את מעילו, ויגוז את ראשו, ויפול ארצה וישכחו. ויאמר, ארום יצאתי מבית אמי, וארום אשוב שמה, השם נתן והשם לקח, יהי שם השם מבורך. בכל זאת לא חטא איוב, ולא נתן תפילה לאלוקים.
תפלה
לאלוקים.
Okay, translate, please.
Satan then departed from the presence of God. It happened one day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in the home of their eldest brother that a messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing and the she-donkeys were grazing alongside them when the Zabians befell and seized them. They struck down the servants by the edge of the sword. Only I, by myself, escaped to tell you." This one was still speaking when this other one came and said, "A fire of God fell from the heavens. It burned among the sheep and the servants and consumed them. Only I, myself, escaped to tell you." This one was still speaking when this other one came and said, "The Chaldeans formed three divisions and deployed around the camels and seized them. They struck down the servants by the edge of the sword. Only I, myself, escaped to tell you." This one was still speaking when this other one came and said, "Your sons and your daughters were eating and drinking wine in the home of their eldest brother, when behold, a great wind came from across the desert. It struck the four corners of the house. It collapsed upon the young men and killed them. Only I, by myself, escaped to tell you." Job stood up and ripped his shirt, and he tore the hair of his head. He threw himself upon the ground and prostrated himself. He said, "Naked did I emerge from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. God has given, and God has taken away. Blessed be the name of God." Despite all this, Job did not sin nor ascribe impropriety to God.
Lona Tantiflalokim. Eov did not sin and he did not curse God. Now let's go very quickly through the next group of psukim and then we can begin analyzing. Yes, please.
Why is it that it says that both in the last part that the sons and daughters were eating and yet only the sons die?
Good for you for noticing. I'm not going to answer until we get to the very end.
Okay.
Good for you for noticing. Good for you for noticing. Okay. Perek Beit, chapter 2. I want to read through very, very quickly and then we can begin analyzing together. So go ahead, Shlomit.
Vayi
ayom.
את השם ויאמר משום בארץ ומתהלך בה. ויאמר השם אל השטן, שמת לבך את לבך אל עדי איוב, כי אין כמו בארץ, ישכן וישר וירא אלוקים ושר מרע, ועודנו מחזיק בטומאתו, ואתה עשיתני בו לבלעו פינן. ויען השטן את השם ויאמר, אור בעד אור, וכל אשר האיש ייתן בעד נפשו, אולם שלח מידך וגא אל עצמו ואל בשרו, אם לא אל פניך יברכך. ויאמר השם אל השטן, הינו בידיך, אך את נפשו שמור. ויצא השטן מאת פני השם, ויך את איוב בשכין רע, ויקף רגלו עד קודקודו. ויקח לו חרס להתגרד בו, והוא יושב בתוך האפר, ותאמר לו אשתו, אותך מחזיק בתומתיך, ברך אלוקים ומת.
ומות.
ומת.
ומות.
ומות, לא. ויאמר אליה, כדבר אחת הנבלות תדבר, גם את הטוב מקבל מהאלוקים, וגם את הרע, ואת הרע לא מקבל, וכל זאת לא חייב.
I'm going to translate because I want to translate this from the Hebrew. And the day came and the angels stood before God and the Satan came amongst them to stand before God. Hashem said to the Satan, "From where do you come?" And the Satan answered, God, from passing through the earth and mishut ba'aretz u'mitalech ba, passing through the earth and walking upon it. Hashem said to the Satan, "Did you note my servant Eov, that there is none like him in the whole land, a perfect man who is honest and God-fearing and distances himself from evil, and he still clings to his perfection, and you have for nothing seduced me to harm him." The Satan said to God, he said, "Skin for skin. Everything that a man has, he will give for his soul. But send out your hand and touch him himself and his flesh and see if he does not bless you." God said to the Satan, "He's in your hand, but keep him alive." The Satan went out from before God and he smote Eov with foul boils from his foot to his head, and he took a piece of clay, a clay shard, to scratch himself with, and he was sitting in the dust. His wife said to him, "You're still holding on to your innocence. Bless God and die." He said to her, "You speak like one of the Nevelot." How is that translated? You speak like one of the fools. You speak like one of the fools. The good we will receive for God, from God, and we will not receive the bad. Nevertheless, Eov did not sin with his lips. Now you notice a change, because the first time we were told about Eov that he what? That he did not sin. And this time we're told he did not sin with his mouth. So something is going on inside of him. Please tell me what you think is going on here. How do you understand this? What's going on? What do you make of this?
I was in a lot of trouble with the Satan stories. And, you know, why does God have to prove something to the Satan?
Yeah, I'm with you, Wendy. I'm with you.
I also asked, what's the history behind this? Because I can't conceive of a depiction of Hashem this way as compared to Tanakh, or, I mean, you know, the rest of the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
So, this is a capricious God that doesn't seem to have, any concern other than just keeping him alive, even at the worst of circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, it seems just, it's cruel, it's a...
It doesn't fit into Tanakh. Sharon?
I'm going to ask a semi-heretical question. We know that many of the stories in Tanakh are paralleled in other literatures at the time, the flood story and other stories.
Mm-hmm.
Does this have a parallel that you know of? I'm not on top of those things, but does it have a parallel?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't know the answer to that. Let's.
You know, it doesn't fit into Tanakh. I'm wondering where
does it fit into?
Where does
it fit into?
There wasn't some argument.
Sharon, you asked me a wonderful question. I'll try to check that. I've read something about that, but I can't pull it up right now.
I have an idea. That's a question.
Okay. Anyone else? What do you make of this?
I echo, why is God following what the sage and the challenge? Why is he taking the challenge?
God is taking on the challenge, and an individual who is a model of goodness, righteousness, saintliness is suffering.
Yeah. When I think of the phrase, I'll take touch the last time. So God is extolling the virtues of the Yog. And that is when Yog, when the Satan says, well, don't, you know. So it gives you that whole concept of maybe. And I think Yog had that beginning when he gave the Korban up, because he was a little bit afraid of, maybe superstitious of all the good that he had and all the children and all the feasting, and that's not comfortable for him, so he wants to appease, or in some ways appease God by giving him, by giving him for my thoughts. And I have to pull it all together, but then it was bothering me when the story is that Hashem is sort of extolling his virtues. That puts him in a situation where someone has to say, oh, well, he's a great guy because he has all this money. Because I once learned about Lashon Hara, not to say even good things about people.
So you don't provoke someone else?
Well, someone to say something bad about them.
Uh-huh. Okay, so?
The other thing that's always bothering me about this is his children were real people. And his children were real people with lives of their own. And yet, they are killed capriciously. Nobody talks about the tragedy to them of having their lives shortened. It's only a matter of they're just an instrument of Job's.
That has always troubled me greatly, because what happens at the end of the story? He had 10 children. At the end of the story, he gets
double.
It's great, but what happens to those original? What happens to those original children? That's always something that that for me, the inability to live with that is for me a key to unlocking the story. Stay tuned. Stay tuned. Not today, but stay tuned. Yes.
One of the things I think that's interesting so far about this story, as opposed to so many of the others that we read, is that at the get-go, it's a very philosophically based argument that people have.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just stepping right into that. And I don't see that in a lot of, you know, the other texts, where right from the get-go, you get the big philosophical kind of questions of life.
Not just from the get-go, but this book is unique in all of Tanakh in taking on a philosophical issue directly and dealing with a philosophical issue. Other...
Unlike, you know, through rabbinic literature and everything else, which is, you know, philosophy based. It's
Well, unlike Tanakh, which is either based upon narrative or homiletics or law, you're dealing here directly with a whole book that's dealing with the philosophical issue of the role of suffering and faith in religious life. Absolutely, absolutely. Anyone else have anything to say? Yes, Chavi.
What's running through my mind is the only other venue where we really hear this concept, I believe it's the Yom Kippur davening, where there's a piyut, I don't know how to say English, of Haskat Tegor. Like the idea, even the idea that there is an adversary and that we're fighting against, we're trying to quell the arguments of the adversary, and it's straight out
of the oath. No question about it. No question about it. You're right, Kavi. Nicole?
Something like what Harvey was just saying. I think that maybe they're just trying to present like both sides of the story. It doesn't even have to be an adversary like a Satan. Like, they want to play out both sides so you can see both sides of the equation in this test. And the test reminds me a lot of Akedah Yitzhak. That's what's coming to mind immediately, where they're testing, but you want to see both sides, like why there's a need for a test and what the counter-argument is.
Chazal, in their commentary on Akedah Yitzhak, have Avraham speaking the words of Eov. They have Satan and Avraham having a conversation, and Eov is quoted. So you're noting something that Chazal noted. Now, what I'd like to do is as follows. I want to look first at, was Eov a historical figure? Where did Eov live? He was the wealthiest man where? Kedem, the Eretz Kedem. We call B'nai Kedem. He was the wealthiest person we call B'nai Kedem. Where in Tanakh have you encountered B'nai Kedem, Eretz Kedem, Ked... Well, the first time we have it is Gan Eden. Gan Eden, they are banished where? Mikedem. Mikedem, east of Gan Eden. But there, we're not necessarily calling Kedem a physical, an actual place, a geographical place. But I want you to look in Bereishit, because the names that we encounter in Perek Aleph of Iyov are names that are known to us, that are recognized by us from the book of Bereishit. I'm just going to quote here. Let's take a look at the end of Parshat Noach. The end of Parshat Noach, right after the dispersion of the nations in the Plaga. Look at chapter 10, Perek Yud. The very end of Perek Yud, as you see the dispersion, you see where the sons of Shem dwell. Pasuk Lamed, Perek Yud, Pasuk Lamed, Perek 10, chapter 10, Pasuk 30. You're told that the sons of Shem dwelled from Mesha, Bochasvara. What's the end of that? Har HaKedem. They're the extent of the Prisa, where the spread of B'nai Shem reached Har HaKedem. Look at the beginning of the next Perek, when we're introducing the Plaga. Perek, chapter 11. Vayikal kol ha'aretz safachat u'dvarim echadim vayihi v'nas'am mikedem. What does Mikedem mean? The generation that built the tower found a place to live when they journeyed Mikedem. Kedma means eastward, but Mikedem means what? From Kedem. Take a look at something more. Look at Avraham Avinu right before he dies, his second, his last marriage. The end of Parashat Chaye Sarah. Avraham remarried, chapter 25, Perek Kaf Hei. Avraham remarried a woman named Keturah, and she bore him 6 children. One of the names is going to be important to us in Iyov. The youngest of his later children is named what? Shuach, and one of Iyov's friends will be called Bildad Hashuchi. Take a look at where he sent them. He gave them gifts. Pasuk Hey, Pasuk 5. Vayten Avraham et kol asher lo liYitzchak. Avraham gave all of his possessions to Yitzchak. V'livnei ha'pilagshim asher l'Avraham natan Avraham matanot. And to the sons of Avraham's concubines, he gave gifts. Vayishalchei me'al Yitzchak v'nogodenu chai. He sent them from... upon Yitzchak, his son, during his lifetime, Kedma, eastward, El Eretz, Kedem, to the land of Kedem. Avraham obviously came from Kedem, and he has, according to Rashbam, holdings, lands, and inheritances in the east, and he wants to make sure that Yitzchak is going to inherit the land of Israel, and he sends his other sons eastward to the land of Kedem, in order to inherit his lands there. Now, Iyov has enormous wealth. His wealth isn't in investments where you can live in a, you can live in a little pied-à-terre and you can have all the investments all over the world. Iyov has cattle. His cattle are going to be plowing his fields, and he has sheep, and his sheep need grazing land. Where is there grazing land? Think of the land of Israel. You don't have grazing land in Israel. Which of the tribes were heavy in sheep? Reuven, Gad, and Chatzim Menashe. And what did they wish to do? What? They didn't want to come into the land of Israel, which is a land of hills and valleys. Eretz harim uvaot mimtar hashamayim tishteh mayim. They wanted to be able to graze their lands in the large open fields, and that you have that you have Kedem, that you have from the Golan and eastward, you have large plains. So I just want us to know, when you look at all the historical references, you look at the names, pick where the land that Eov is from. He's from where?
Utz.
Did we ever hear of Utz? Yes, we did. Yes, we did. Not as a land, but as a person. Where did we hear of Utz?
Right at the end of Vayera.
Good for you. Good for you. Right after the Akedah, when Milcah has sons to Nahor. Nahor is Abraham's brother. The eldest son is named what? Utz. Utz. The eldest son is Utz. What I'm trying to point out to you is that we have a story here who's with names, and you'll see this throughout the book of Eov. The nomenclature belongs to a very, very early period in Jewish life. We have these references. We have these references during the patriarchal period. We don't have these names afterwards. We have these names during the life of Avraham Avinu, before the life of Avraham Avinu. You also see, when you see the description of Eov, you think of another biblical figure. Who do you immediately think of? Ish haya be'eretz Utz, Yoav shmo v'haya ish ahu tam v'yashar v'yirei Elokim v'sar meha. You think of whom?
Noah.
I would think of Noah. I would think of Noah. Well, you might think of Abraham, who is described as Yirei, ata yadati ki Yirei Elokim ata, who is God-fearing, but the description of Abraham does not say tam v'yashar. That is a description of Noah. And I want to show you a very interesting pasuk in Yechezkel. Turn to the book of Yechezkel. You'll see that not just we noticed this. Look at Yechezkel chapter 14. And we're not doing anything with this today. Today we're just setting the stage. This is to make you come back. Yechezkel Perek Yudalet, chapter 14. In which Hashem is telling Yechezkel, in the words of Yechezkel, Hashem is telling people that it's your righteousness that's going to save you. You're not going to be saved by anyone else's righteousness. But let's read. Pasuk 13, Yud Gimel. Ben Adam, God is speaking to Yechezkel, Eretz ki techtali, lim'ol ma'al. If man, human being, son of man, if a land sins to betray me, v'natiti yadi aleha v'shavarti la matei lachem, I will pass my hand, says God, over this land, and I will break its staff of bread, v'shlachti bara'av, and I will send within it famine, v'hichrati mimena adam uvehema, and I will wipe out man and animal. And if these three people are in that land, Noah, Daniel, Eov, they in their righteousness will save their souls, Nu'um Hashem Elokim, the words of Hashem Elokim, and if I bring a wild animal through the land, v'shikleta, v'aitashmama bibli over mipnei hachaya, and if the wild animal destroys the civilization, shloshet ha'anashim ha'ele b'tocha chaya ninum Hashem Elokim, these three people within the land, I swear, says God, Hashem Elokim, im banim uvanot yasli latzilu, I swear that they will not save sons and daughters. They alone will be saved. And of course you're all thinking, hold it, Noah saved his sons and his daughters. V'ha'aretz tiyeh shmama, but the land will be fallow. O cherev avi al ha'aretz ahi v'amarti, cherev tavor ba'aretz v'yichrati mimena adam uveima, o shloshet ha'anashim ha'ilo v'tocha, chay aninum Hashem Elokim, lo yatzilu banim uvanot, ki hem levadam yinatzelu. God says, or if I bring a sword through the land, I swear they will not save sons or daughters. Just they alone will be saved. O devar ha'shalach el ha'aretz ahi v'shafachti chamati alei abedam la'achrit mimena adam uveima. Or if I bring a plague upon the land and I pour out my fury upon the land to remove from it man and animal, v'noach v'daniel v'yov b'tocha, if Noach, if Daniel and Ichiyov will be within the land. I swear that they will not save their children. They alone will be saved. Now we're going to do a lot with this, but not this shiur. But this shiur, I want to point out that it is not just we who have noticed the obvious parallel between Noach and between Noach and between Iyov. So what do we have? We have biblical references of geography, and we'll see the names are also going to be Eliphaz HaTemani. They're both sons of Eliphaz is the son of Esav. Likewise, Teman. You're going to see names that we know from the very, very early biblical period. Yechezkel notes the parallel between Iyov and Noach. Who is Iyov? So take a look at the sources. If there's anyone who doesn't have sources, there are sources on the table. You have a Gemara in Bava Batra Tetvav. You have this in either Hebrew or English. Amar Rabbi Levi Bar Lachma, Iyov bimei Moshe haya. Ktiv hacha, Iyov yutet, mi tenefo v'yichtvun milai, uchtiv hatam, shmot lam gimel, ubamei yivada efo. Rabbi Levi Bar Lachma said Iyov was at the time of Moshe. It is written here in Iyov, who would give indeed that my words be written, and it is written there in Shmot, and how will it be known indeed? You have the word, use of the word Efo, the word use of the word indeed in both places, in reference to Iyov and in reference to Moshe. So Rabbi Levi says, well, since that word Efo occurs in both places, obviously Iyov is during the time of Moshe. You're sitting here and you're saying what?
Come on.
You haven't convinced me, because the word Efo is not intrinsically associated either with Iyov. It's almost the word indeed. Well, we're not convinced. Rava Amar Iyov bimei meraglim haya. Rava says Iyov was in the time of the spies. And then we also have a parallel reference. Ktiv hacha ish haya be'eretz utz Iyov shmo ktiv hatam bamidbar yud gimel hayesh ba'etz. Rava says Iyov was in the time of the spies, because the spies asked, Moshe asked them, is there an eitz, a tree in the land? And here we have utz. Wendy says no good. Yitiv ha'hu rav mirabanan kamei rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmani v'yitiv v'kamar Iyov lo haya v'lo nivra ela mashal haya. One of the rabbis sat before Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachmani and says, Iyov never was and never will be. This is a parable. Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Elazar, Amrei Tarvaihu, Iyov me'olei gola haya uveg midrasho bitveria haya. Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Elazar both said, Iyov was from the returnees, the time of the return from Babel to build the second temple. As a matter of fact, his Beit Midrash was in Tveria.
How could they get this? I mean, he had thousands of camels and sheep. And, I mean, this was not the time when people were...
Had thousands of camels and sheep. Right. It is absolutely true. Absolutely true. Do you know who lived in Tveria and who had a Beit Midrash in Tveria?
Yes.
Who?
I'm just thinking
who is the most famous sage in Tveria who had his Beit Midrash there? Rabbi Yochanan. And Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Elazar said, Iyov
is one of us.
Came up from Babel, just as Rabbi Yochanan did. And as a matter of fact, he lives right here. His Beit Midrash is in Tveria. Rabbi Yochanan buried 10 sons. Let's go on. Rabbi Elazar Omer, not just did he bury 10 sons, he was orphaned at birth. His father died during the pregnancy.
So he's saying Iyov is me?
He's saying Iyov
every
is
man.
Me.
Every man.
He's saying that. You got it, Sharon. You got it. Rabbi Elazar Omer, Iyov bimei shvot ha-shoftim haya, sh'nemar, hein atem kulchem chazitem, v'lama zeh tehevel tehevalu. Same type of reference. Rabbi Elazar has a reference, and he says Eov was during the time of the judges. Rabbi Yoshua ben Karcha Amar, Eov bimei Achashverosh haya. Guess who Eov was?
Mordechai.
No. Think of the other character, Esther.
That Eov is Esther.
Yeah. Eov was in the time, that's what I think he's saying. Eov was in the time of Achashverosh, as it says in Eov Membe. It says there were no more women more beautiful than the daughters of Eov when were there. Well, we're connecting many, many figures with Eov. Rabbi Natan Omer Eov bimei Malchut Shva haya. I didn't bring you the reference. Chachamim Omer Eov bimei Kastim haya. Eov was in the time of Queen of Sheba. Eov was in the time of Babylonians. V'yesh Omer Eov bimei Yaakov haya. Eov was in the time of Jacob. V'dina bat Yaakov nasa. We couldn't make Eov into Dina because Eov is a man, but we make Eov into the person who's marrying Dina. כתיב הכה כדבר אחת הנבלות תדברי וכתיב הכה כנבלה עשה בישראל. It says regarding Dina, regarding Eov, do you speak like one of the wicked women? And it says in regarding Dina, he did a wicked thing against Israel. What's this saying? I just want to go further, one step further. No. Let's analyze this right now. According to this, when did Eov live? So you have several different ways you can understand this. One of the ways you can understand this is that everyone here is saying Eov was indeed a historical figure, and he lived at this time, and then we say, but the proofs are tenuous. So we have to say that the proof is not intended as a proof. The proof is intended sort of as a hook to hang this onto the pasuk. But the real point is that someone is saying, I know when Eov lived. And then you have Sharon saying, no. What this is saying, this Gemara is saying, Eov is every man. Eov is in every single generation. There is always an Eov. Eov is a situation that is vastly more, that is prevalent within our lives. And you certainly have that stated by Rabbi Yochanan. Now, regarding Eov's suffering, you have two approaches that I wanted to bring you, and then we're going to work with a third approach. I want to look first at two approaches. Look at source number three, which is Shmot Rabbah. Shmot Rabbah. Amar Rabbi Chama Bar Chanina. B'sha'a sheyatzu Yisrael mimitzrayim amad Samael hamalach lekatrei gotam. ורבי חמא בר חנינא פרשה משום אביו משל לרועה שהיה מעביר צונו בנהר בא זאב להתגרות בצון רועה שהיה בקי, מה עשה? נטל תיש גדול ומסרו לו אמר יהי מתגשש בזה עד שנעבור את הנהר ואחר כן אני מביאו כך בשעה שיצאו ישראל ממצרים עמד סמאל המלאך לקטרג אותם אמר לפני הקדוש ברוך הוא ריבונו של עולם עד עכשיו היו אלו עובדים עבודת כוכבים ואתה קורא להם את הים? מה עשה הקדוש ברוך הוא? מסר לו איוב שהיה מיועצי פרות יכתיב לשתם וישר אמר לו הנך הינו בידיך אמר הקדוש ברוך הוא עד שהוא מתעסק עם איוב ישראל עולים לים ויורדים ואחר כך עציר את איוב Rabbi Chama Bar Chanina said, when Israel went out of Egypt, the angel Samael stood up to accuse them. And Rabbi Chama Bar Chanina explained this in his father's name. The parable of a shepherd who's bringing his flock across a river, a wolf comes to harry the flock. An expert shepherd, what does he do? He takes a large ram and he gives it to the wolf. He says, let the wolf tussle with this ram until we cross the river, and afterwards I will bring the ram over. Thus at the time that Israel went out of Mitzrayim, the angel Samael stood up to accuse them. He said before the Holy One, blessed be He, Master of the Universe, until now, these were idolaters, and you tear the sea for them? What did the Holy One, blessed be He, do? He gave him the Satan Eov, who was one of Pharaoh's counselors, of whom it is written, a whole and upright man. And he said to the Satan, he here he is in your hand. The Yov is in your hand. The Holy One, blessed be he, said, while the Satan is busy with the Yov, Israel will go up to the sea and go down, they'll cross the sea, and then I'll save the Yov.
So he's thrown to the wolves.
He's a decoy who was thrown to the wolves so Israel can get through the sea. Tell me, please, what this is saying.
Well, it says God in the way only challenges or tests people who stand the test, but this brings us back to the problem of the children and his kids.
It certainly does, and you're just going to have to stay tuned with the children, because we're not going to get to the children for a while, but I told you there's going to be a surprise ending. It's going to be a good ending, a surprise ending. What do you think this means? How do you explain this? What's this saying about the book of Eov? Eov is a book that's dealing with faith, in faith in the face of suffering. It's dealing with meaningless suffering. It's dealing with capriciousness of life.
Well, it's saying also that the suffering is not meaningless.
Yeah. And in other words, Rabbi Chama Bar Chanina is taking what looks to us to be purposeless suffering, and he's saying there has to be a greater cosmic purpose that's served by this suffering. And then he gives us a scenario that he constructs in which Eov, by his suffering, is actually saving. He's going to be himself saved at the end. Don't worry about the children now. But he's going to himself be saved at the end. But this suffering comes for some larger cosmic purpose. On the other hand, you have a Gemara that... I have to bring this to you, although I find this Gemara upsets me very, very much. It does not upset Rav Soloveitchik, but Rav Soloveitchik upsets me very much in what he says about Eov. So we're gonna look at the Gemara, and we're going to look at Rav Soloveitchik, and we have to, but we're going to go other places. We have two more things we have to read, and then we can finish. The Gemara is source for Amar Sota Yud Aleph, Amar Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba, Amar Rabbi Simai. Shlosha Yu Bota Eitza, Bilam V'Yov V'Yitov. Bilam Sheyatz Neharag, Yov Sheshatak Nidon V'Yisurim, Yitro Shebarach Zachor Mibnei Banav Sheyashvu B'Lizkat HaGazit. Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba said in the name of Rabbi Simai. There were three in that council. Paro had three counselors when he was considering enslaving the Jews. There were three in that council, Bilam, Eov, and Yitro. And what he's going to say is none of them really... Bilam, who gave counsel, was killed. Eov, who was silent, was judged with suffering. Yitro, who fled, his grandchildren merited sitting in the chamber of hewn stone as members of the Sanhedrin. What's Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba saying about... Eov?
That he was complicit.
That I believe that even though Eov on the outside was Tam V'Yashar, this would not have happened if on the inside, he's so worried about what's going on in the hearts of his children. Well, I believe that Eov sinned. I believe that Eov sinned or this could not have happened. I'm not taking that approach. I'm not taking that route, and I don't think the book is taking that route. But I just have to tell you that this exists. We're going to end with reading the Rambam and then tune in next month. We've just laid the groundwork, and next month we're really going to start learning. Rambam, and I'm going to read in English. From Moren Vuchim, Chenek Gimel, Perek Kaf Beit, he says as follows. The matter of Eov is wondrous and astonishing. It is a parable to clarify the approaches of men to divine providence. You know that some of the stages stated explicitly, Eov never existed nor was created, but was a parable. And those who held that Eov was a historical figure did not know how to place him in a time or place. In other words, he's saying, it doesn't convince me. He who says he lived at this time, he lived at that time. It says Eifo, so he must have lived in the time of Moshe. But one of the sages said he lived during the time of the patriarchs, another during the time of Moses, another during the time of David. I am simply interpolating here. On the other hand, it is absolutely clear that the historical references, the names, come from the patriarchal period. That's clear, because we don't have these names later, and we do have these names earlier. But Rambam says, one of the sages said he lived during the time of the patriarchs, another during the time of Moses, another during the time of David, and that he was amongst the returned exiles from Babylonia. This all strengthens the opinion that he never existed nor was created. In summary, whether he was or wasn't, all thinkers amongst men have always been perplexed about such a condition, that a good, pure, God-fearing man whose deeds were righteous should suffer such calamities one following the next, his possessions, his children, his body. You notice, by the way, when we had the chain of calamities, they came from every direction. We first start with Shiva coming from the south. And then we have, what was the order? The order was, Shva came from the south and killed all of the servants, and they stole all of the, and they stole the livestock. And they stole cattle. They stole the cattle. And then the next says, lightning came out of heaven and it caused the fire and all of the sheep. So you have the south, and then you have coming out of heaven, and then you have the Babylonians coming from the north with three forces, and they surround the camels and they steal them all. And then you have a wind coming and the house collapses. So you see that the attack upon Yov is coming from all over. And I'm just in inserting this into the Rambam. You also notice that Mrs. Eov, you ask, why is Mrs. Eov looking for exactly the same thing as the Satan did? The Satan wants Eov to curse God, and what does Mrs. Eov want?
She wants him to be out of his misery.
She wants him to be out of his misery, so curse God and be out of your misery. Mrs. Eov has realized the same thing that Eov has realized, and that's the difference between before the boils and after the boils. He realizes he's been singled out, he's been selected to suffer, and he's asking the question, she's asking the question, why me? Why me? Why you? Why you? And you have been singled out for whatever the reason is to suffer. That's the ultimate question that I think that we all grapple with when something happens. Why is God relating differently to everyone else than he's relating to me? Now let's go on with the Rambam. All thinkers amongst men have always been perplexed about such a condition, that a good, pure, God-fearing man whose deeds were righteous should suffer such calamities one following the next, to his possessions, his children, his body, for no sin on his part, until they said what they did about God's foreknowledge and providence. According to both opinions, that is, whether he existed or not, those opening words of Satan and the words of God to Satan, and his handing Eov over to Satan, any intelligent being realizes that this is beyond doubt a parable. In other words, Rambam says, up until you get to the point of Satan speaking to God, when you're talking about what's going on down here, so those people say it's a parallel, these people say it's not a parallel, was such a historical figure. But once you start talking about Satan and God, quite obviously that is a parallel. All people, I mean the masses, exalt God in their words and describe him as doing justice and goodness only at times of happiness and material well-being, or even in times of tolerable misfortune. But when they experience calamities like those mentioned in Eov, some of them deny God and believe the world is without order. And Rambam says that's what this book is. That's what this book is about. So it's going to be a book about faith that has to do with how man grapples with a world that he cannot make sense of. For next month, you are going to get homework, and it will be to read Sefer Prakim. This is not a simple book, but Be'ezrat Hashem, this book is going to bring us much meaning. Be thrilled.
What puzzled me is just this last time, the first time in my life, I realized that we have no